Swami Mangalananda talked about first learning that song. He was in Vrindavan. Vrindavan is the site where Krishna spent his younger days, had his leelas there. Described a bright moonlit night as they were walking back to the ashram from out in the valley there. And they started singing this, and they just became intoxicated with the song as they sang it, not being able to get enough of it. And you can picture it, and it's a beautiful, beautiful tune. And so it's lovely to have it here today. I would like to read from Songs of Kabir. My body and my mind are grieved for want of thee, O my beloved. Come to my house. When people say that I am thy bride, I'm ashamed, for I have not touched thy heart with my heart. Then what is this love of mine? I have no taste for food, I have no sleep. My heart is ever restless within doors and without. As water is to the thirsty, so is the lover to the bride. Who is there that will carry my news to my beloved? Kabir is restless, for he is dying for the sight of him. In India, the soul is considered in the feminine sense. There was a wonderful devotee of Krishna, and she was entranced with Krishna and felt such great divine love and was truly a great saint. And one day, a Brahmin said that she could not enter since she was a woman. And she says, I thought that we were all women as brides before the one. And with that saying, then the Brahmin recognized what a great saint she was. It's similar to the Christian becoming a bride for Christ. And what a beautiful, wonderful kind of relationship to have with God, to be a lover, to be a bride, to look for that consummate union with the divine. We're greatly privileged to have master's interpretations of the Gita. I read from them often because I find such great inspiration. There is tremendous wisdom and knowledge that is conveyed through these writings. Master and Sri Yukteswar, as well as Lari Mahasya, all had great reverence for the Gita. And so we get so much from being able to read these, and we also have some of the original East-West magazines, and this comes from the first time that Master gave an interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita, the Song of Spirit. This is the translation. Within itself, the blind mind consulted introspection, the impartial judge of all states of consciousness, asking, my children of crooked mental tendencies, or the Kurus, and the pure discriminative faculties, the pure Pandus, eager for different psychological battles, what did they? The blind, boisterous mind wanted the introspective faculty to reveal the battles between the sense-bent mental tendencies and the pure, wisdom-loving, discipline-loving, self-control-evolving wisdom faculties. And so we have laid out before us that within all of us are these psychological tendencies. The Kurus are the family that goes against the light. They are the ego-bound and blind, come from the blind sense mind. And we have the Pandus. And these are the liberators. These are the tendencies within us, both psychological and spiritual, that uplift the soul and bring it higher into consciousness. This is essential for understanding the inner meaning of the Gita. Continuing, the Bhagavad Gita in the first stanza speaks of the glaring truths of how life is a series of battles between spirit and matter, knowledge and ignorance, soul and body, life and death, health and disease, changelessness and change, self-control and temptation, discrimination and the senses. In the mother's body, the baby has to battle with disease, darkness, and ignorance. Each child has to fight also the battle of heredity. The soul has to overcome many hereditary difficulties. It also has to contend with the self-created influencing effect of the prenatal karma or past actions. A study of the Bhagavad Gita is of little use unless it is applied in practical life, so that the vastness of the inner import of the first stanza can only be understood when we know how to apply it in various phases of life. I think that it is true that many of us have difficulty coming into this world, particularly those who have achieved a higher state of evolution. In between lives and this material world, we ascend up to our heavenly world. There are those who get glimpses of this, perhaps through near-death experiences. There are those who have some spontaneous kind of insight or intuition into this higher life, into these higher worlds that are beautiful, that are more evolved than what we find in general here in the material world. As a result of that, when we come into this material world, we feel that it is very rough play, even from the beginning, as Master said, even as we are in the womb. We have to fight off disease. We have to fight off perhaps the tendencies of the mother or the environment that the mother is in that is difficult. We receive the vibrations of that, and we are wide open because we are coming from that higher plane. We come into this world, and it's difficult just getting birth through the birth canal. It's a struggle. And I know for myself, my own tendency was to avoid the struggle, was to wish it away in some way. And it took a long, long time in living this life and through spiritual practice. Finally, it came to me how much resistance I had to just being in this world. I didn't like being in this world. I didn't feel that it was right for me, that I was right for it. I felt like I belonged someplace else. And I realized at that point that I had prenatal memories that I was constantly comparing this world to, and this world fell short by a long ways. So we have to prepare ourselves if we are to live in this world. Now, we can drag our feet. We can bemoan our fate that we are here at all, or we can get with the program. We can begin to see what the true purpose of life is, that we have come here to do battle. Sometimes people will ask me this idea of mystical crucifixion, this idea of being on a battlefield as with Arjuna and Krishna, isn't there an easier way? And of course, it's not that all life is terrible and hard, and in general, we can find many bright spots to this life. But the inner attitude that I have come here to do my work, I have come here to spiritually evolve, and that if I were perfected already, good chances are I wouldn't be here in the first place. So I have a work to do, and whether it's for myself or whether it's for others, it really makes no difference. I need to adjust my attitude, and that was the thought that came to me. I need to quit resisting the idea that I'm here at all. I am here. And this is my time on the stage. This is my time to live this life and to live it fully, to live it completely. Mother oftentimes said that she lived life fully, from a human and a divine perspective. And I realized that I had one foot in and one foot out because I was constantly looking for some escape route, some way out. This world can be a tough place to be. And sometimes we get it right from the beginning. You see, sometimes when fetuses or newborn children go through difficult times, and my heart goes out to them because this life is rough enough without having an entry like that. But whatever our situation is, it's perfect for us, for the individual. It's perfect. It's perfectly designed. From a human standpoint, we can look out and we can see random events, what appear to be random events. But as we grow spiritually, we begin to understand that the law of cause and effect is absolute. It's not just an idea that we adopt or a theory that we like. We actually begin to see in every situation how this law of cause and effect is a complex chain and a weave in our lives and the people around us, support us in going in certain directions. Now, we have free will, so we can change those directions. We can either attune ourselves to the light, and there are some circumstances where children are born into families with all the advantages. They have spiritual parents. They are given many of the material things that would make for a comfortable lifestyle, and yet they just seem to steer themselves for the ditch, determined to get there. And there are many who would trade places with them for anything in the world, and yet they just seem to throw it away with both hands. It is because there are tendencies that we are born with. And as we go through different evolutionary changes, evolutionary in the sense of just evolving as a human being and growing into adulthood, at different stages, different tendencies are triggered. So what may not be an issue when we're 2 years old, when we're 12 years old, suddenly comes to the fore. It's because the situation that we're in and the development of our body reminds us in a deep subconscious state of previous lifetimes, and so those tendencies start coming forward. And we have to battle them if they're negative tendencies, if they're negative habits. We have to be willing to take it on, and that's why Master said this world is a battlefield. And our lives are a battlefield, both inside and outside. Now, this would be very tiring and wearing out if it were not for the support and the help and the love that we receive within from the divine consciousness. This is the true meaning of Arjuna being in the chariot with Krishna. He stands in the back and he allows Krishna to be the charioteer, the driver of the chariot. He guides the horses. Those tendencies, those life energies that draw us forward in life. When we take a back seat, that is not to say we don't take responsibility for our lives, but we give the responsibility over to God, and then our responsibility becomes to attuning ourselves with the divine consciousness. This is a full-time job to do that kind of attunement. And so we put Krishna in the front, and we attune ourselves to him. He drives us through the battlefield. We have support. We have love. We have light. We have direction if we will listen to it. If we grab the reins and say, I don't have time for this. I need to take control here. I don't feel like Krishna is doing his job properly. Then we're in trouble. And so this idea of surrender is really a challenge, really a challenge. And so this is the symbology of this Gita chapter. Master goes on, in creation, this great battle between spirit and the imperfect expressions of nature is continuously going on. Everywhere in the world, we can witness the silent battle between perfection and imperfection. Everywhere, the perfect wisdom patterns of spirit have to contend with the imperfect patterns of universal delusion. Something is trying to consciously express all good, and something is consciously trying to foil all good with secret attempt of evil expressions. The human body is a veritable battleground of the war between wisdom and ignorance, between wisdom and conscious delusive force. Every aspirant, every spiritual aspirant, who wants the rule of the king of the soul king in the bodily kingdom by defeating the rebel king ego and his powerful sense allies, must every night before sleep introspectively compare and know the vast differences in all their minutest details. This ability to reflect on our lives is something that I became aware of as essential to all psychological and spiritual growth in my work as a counselor. If a person has an inability to reflect on their own lives, what was my part in this? What did I do to contribute? And this is not an overdeveloped sense of guilt. In fact, guilt interferes with true introspection. Sanjay is the personality that is being described in the Gita, and he is that calm introspection. We must have a calm mind in order to really analyze things. Otherwise, we're reacting emotionally, and we live in a reactive state. To really be able to see the situation as it truly is, we have to be able to step back from things. How did I do? We have such a tendency to become defensive. Well, I wouldn't have done this if they hadn't done that, as if that justifies practically anything we want to do or say. And it's not so. We, as individuals, you, me, everyone, are responsible for what we do, for the words that we say. And everything that you do and everything that you say is a creation. It goes out from you, and it reverberates out from you to all of this world. I thought a wonderful analogy was I heard one time in a story of a counselor who was counseling a person, and the person had come into their counseling session and said, "You know, I lost my temper the other day, and I said some terrible things. How can I make it right? How can I get those words back?" So the counselor had the individual write everything that they said out on some paper. Then he had the person tear the paper up into little pieces. They stepped outside. It was a very windy, blustery day. And he said, "Now throw the paper up in the air." And as he did so, the gust of wind took it, and those pieces of paper were scattered everywhere. He says, "Now go gather up the pieces of paper." And the person looked at him astonished and said, "I couldn't do it. They've gone everywhere. They're down the block. They're in every direction." He said, "Even so, once you say those words, they're gone. You cannot get them back." Now, we cannot get back those words, but we can learn from our experience. What kind of words do we use through the day? Are they good words? Are they lovely words? Are they uplifting words? Do they take our mind higher towards God and the light? Or do they take us more into a delusive nature? Now, sometimes we're having a difficulty, and it doesn't mean that you can't say what is true. Saints and great masters are oftentimes almost embarrassingly honest. And there are times when I would ask Mother, when I was sitting with her, "How are you doing?" And she would tell me in all detail and glorious living color. And sometimes it was really difficult. It was really difficult. But it was never from a feeling sorry for herself. It was, "This is what is going on with this body. This is what is going on in connection with this person or that person." And it was just purely that being able to observe, as Sanjay is able to do. But when it comes to our habit patterns, we need to be careful. What words do we use? Because everything is a creative power. The same goes with your actions. What does your body language say? What does your smile say? Master used to say, "Become a smile millionaire." You can give away all of these smiles. You can become rich with smiles. And it is amazing that if you look at a baby, for instance, and they smile at you, just what happens in your heart? It just leaps with a little bit of joy. Why not be one who has some grace to them, who brings some light with you when you walk into a room? You know, a wonderful practice to do is anytime you walk into particularly a new situation, but it can be a work situation, it can be anything, in your own home. And when you walk into that building or that room, let your light shine. In your mind's eye, in your third eye point, see the light expanding out and filling up the room that you're in. See it surrounding all the people who are there. When you do this, you will instantly feel at one with everybody there. You may realize how much tension you carry about entering into a new situation. And suddenly, everyone there is a kindred spirit. Everyone there is a brother, a sister, a mother, a son, a child. And you have an instant relationship with them all through that light, because that light is universal. And you become a blessing. I was walking through the hospital the other day. My mother has been in the hospital. She had operation for cancerous cells in the uterus. And as I walked in, it was something that happened spontaneously in me, but I felt this light shining out as I walked down the hallway, and I just felt this light going out and touching all the people who were there. It wasn't anything that I was doing. It was something that was being done through me. But it was a wonderful sense of having that light go out and touch so many who were there, and I'm sure so many who were in need. You have the capacity to be such a great blessing in this world. But how do you use your creative power? Do you use it as a blessing? Do you use it to bless those that you meet, whether they are familiar or strangers? Or do you spread ignorance? Do you spread judgment? Do you spread negativity wherever you go? We are all accountable, every one of us. And so Master is saying that every night, the student of the Bhagavad Gita should, through his own introspection, ask King Soul and his children what they accomplished as they gathered together, eager for the battle of proper management against untoward circumstances which affect the body. The introspective person who follows the behest of King Soul will find the bodily kingdom teeming with mental and physical prosperity, health, and priceless wisdom. In a body ruled by King Soul and his discriminative exercises, the rebels of ego, anger, greed, fear, attachment, pride, and temptation are all executed. The bodily kingdom ruled by the superior forces manifests nothing but peace, abundance, harmony, and wisdom. No disease, failure, or death can dwell in the bodily kingdom during the reign of King Soul. The consciousness in the Superman is really cosmic consciousness. The term here, Superman, actually this was written in 1933, and it was the first time that the comic book character Superman had been written about, but it was an obscure little publication, and I don't think Master is probably familiar with it. Rather, the more common term was used by Friedrich Nietzsche in the 1880s. The Übermensch, the Superman, the superior man. And Nietzsche was not so thrilled with the religious life that he found at the time. And he thought that man, through his reason and through his ability to tame himself and to rise into something higher without divine assistance, was the new age and the way that things would go. And while there is nobility in thinking about raising yourself up and improving yourself through your own self-will, that is an incomplete picture. It is not acknowledging the superior strength and force and wisdom that comes from divine consciousness. And when people don't go far enough within themselves, they only find themselves, they only find their own thoughts. But when they really turn their mind within, when they're willing to do battle with the forces of restlessness and those things that keep us from knowing our divine nature, when that's not really penetrated that to that depth, then you find only yourself. But when you go further, you find the divine dwelling inside of you. And so Master is redefining this Superman from the one who relies on his own self only. And he's saying the real Superman is cosmic consciousness. He is not a victim of imaginary perceptions, fanciful inspirations, or wisdom hallucinations, but he is actually conscious of the unmanifested spirit and also the entire cosmic with all of its details. A person who has become one with omnipresent and omniscient God is aware of the coursing of planets trillions of miles distant and of the flight of a nearby sparrow at the same time. A Superman does not behold spirit from the body, but becomes one with spirit and beholds his body as well as the body of others, and all manifestation is existing within himself. This is a tremendous saying here, that your consciousness united with spirit, united with God, merges into the all consciousness of all creation and beyond all creation. And when you merge into that, it is not just simply an awareness of distant planets or a nearby bird, but it is through a spiritual connection. You can have intuition that will connect you with distant places and people and events, but it comes as information only. But when you attune yourselves to divine consciousness, then that inner awareness comes not just as intuition, but it is divine intuition. Now it is saturated with divine consciousness. There is a wisdom within you that understands why these things have evolved in the way that they have. And it gives you a sense of peace. It gives you a sense of joy. We can develop intuition from a human standpoint, devoid of all spiritual understanding. This is one of the great things Sri Yukteswar once said that the Master, that you can have powers over the entire universe and still be lacking in God realization. Sometimes we associate miraculous powers with knowing God. But really, there are those great masters who manifest nothing in terms of great powers, and yet they have God completely. And there are others who manifest great powers, and yet they are devoid of the divine presence. This is something to understand and to clarify within your own mind so that we do not become confused between powers and realization. In fact, Krishna says in the Gita and elsewhere that powers are the bane of the upward spiritual seeker because they're so enticing. I know in my own experiences that there have been times when powers have made themselves evident, and I could feel their seduction. I could feel how tempting it would be to begin to delve into these things. But thankfully to my guru's teachings, I knew that there was something superior, there was something higher. And I knew that I didn't want that. And I would rather be completely devoid of anything that is called powers, and if that meant that I could have God. God is the fulfillment of all the heart's desires. All the heart's desires. And so then Master talks about the stages of realization that a man has to climb. The man of realization has to climb different steps in the ladder of self-realization as his consciousness moves upward from body consciousness to cosmic consciousness. The first step. By discrimination, the yogi detaches himself from earthly possessions and his little circle of friends. In India, when somebody becomes a sadhu or a swami, it was explained by Swami Satchidananda that they cut off all special relationships with family members. Papa and Mataji were very much surprised one time when Swami Satchidananda's brother, from his previous life of becoming a sadhu or a swami, came to visit the ashram. And while he was there, Swami Satchidananda treated him as he would have treated anybody else who came to the ashram, to the point that Papa and Mataji were not aware that this man was Swamiji's brother. And they marveled at it afterwards because of his equanimity of view. And the idea, Swamiji explained, is not to cut off relationships, but it is to treat all the world as your special relationship. Therefore, nobody in particular can be special to you. Because you love all, you serve all, you see all as divine consciousness, as your divine beloved come to you in that form. And when we only see one or two or a small circle, and then others are outside of that circle, you see, you create artificial separation. And so, first of all, you recognize where those special attachments are, and then you go beyond them. Same thing with material items, that there is no material item that should eclipse your knowingness that God exists within you. When you become greedy, when you want a certain thing and it seems to cloud your judgment, suddenly you want what you want and you're willing to sacrifice perhaps anything in order to get it. And most of all, the presence of God, because you miss the presence in God as you focus upon that material item. And so in this first stage, you realize that those things surrounding you will never give you that true happiness. Then second, the yogi finds his consciousness, although freed from the possessions involved in connection with the body, they still tenaciously remain imprisoned in the body and in human consciousness. So you become aware of the consciousness that is within you, but you realize still that that consciousness is bound by your sense of your body consciousness and your identification with that. So then that becomes the second stage, that you're aware of consciousness, you're aware of that you're aware of these things, but yet you're still bound by them. Then third, the yogi, by deep concentration, tries to silence the internal and external body sensations which invade his body. So you learn to internalize the mind, pratyahara. You learn to focus the mind within and go beyond the attachment to this little body only and the restlessness that's associated with it. The fourth, the yogi learns to quiet his breath and heart and to withdraw attention and energy from the spine. Now really, when we truly meditate, we do exactly this. The life force comes from the restlessness of the mind and of the body. It gets concentrated in the spine and then lifted up in the spine to the higher centers. We focus upon the ajna because that is the gateway to divine consciousness. And so as you focus your mind there, you focus on the breath, you're chanting to God or you're practicing hangsa, and you bring your whole attention there, you may not even realize it, but all of a sudden you're not all that aware of your physical body. You're more aware of the sensation and spiritual energies that are at the ajna. Now you have successfully internalized the mind. And fifth, when the yogi can quiet his heart at will, he passes psychologically beyond the subconscious state. And so now you have complete mastery over yourself. You lift yourself up into the higher divine consciousness. You go beyond the subconscious. Your conscious mind now becomes merged in union with the superconscious mind. And that is where the Superman, as Master defines it, resides in Christ consciousness, in Krishna consciousness, in the Kutastha Chaitanya. It is the consciousness that rises up beyond, where you know that you are part and parcel of the universal being, the Godhead from which everything else has sprung. When you have this and you are able to enter into this state at will, then you have self-mastery. There may be some more to go as you work out any karma that may be left. But as you do so, you purify the mind more and more and more until there is nothing that stands between you and the infinite. This weekend we celebrate Memorial Day. It is originally a time to memorialize those who have fought in righteous battles. And we think of those lives and the sacrifices of those lives that many made, going to distant lands sometimes, and going against darkness. And there is such a thing as a righteous battle, as a righteous war. Sometimes we have to enter into it. But always and forever, there is a righteous war going on right inside of us. The original meaning of jihad that we hear so much today, about taking innocent life, which was never intended and never sanctioned by the Quran or by Muhammad. But jihad originally meant the spiritual battle that's entertained within. And so on this Memorial Day, we can honor those who sacrificed their lives, their comforts, and all that they had for a higher good. But we can also think upon this battle of life. How do I enter into it? How did I do today? Do I take that daily introspection? Do I focus upon myself as a soul? What is my responsibility here? How did I do? Forget the other fellow. Do not justify your actions because of another's behavior. But analyze yourself honestly, truthfully. And where you find fault, then set about correcting the fault. Guilt is not a necessary thing as we enter into the deeper spiritual path. In fact, it becomes an obstacle if we feel too much guilt, because it takes away from the calm introspection that's required to truly analyze and observe our lives. So let us do this. Let us become true spiritual warriors. Let us cast aside our reluctance to enter into the fray. Let us cast aside any kind of negative feelings we have for being here. We are here. There's a purpose for being here. And if you don't know that to be the truth, then assume it to be the truth, at least for now. Release yourself from stepping both feet into the circle. You're here to do a work. You're here to strive spiritually. You're here to make that tremendous realization. And when you do that, you release yourself. You really do. I'd like to close with a writing from Rumi. It's entitled, No Flag. I used to want buyers for my words. Now I wish somebody would buy me away from words. I've made a lot of charmingly profound images, scenes with Abraham and Abraham's father, Uzzah, who was also famous for icons. So, I'm so tired of what I am doing. Then one image without form came, and I quit. Look for someone else to tend to the shop. I am out of the image-making business. Finally, I know freedom of madness. A random image arrives. I scream, "Get out!" It disintegrates. Only love, only the holder, the flag fits into, and wind, no flag. So learn to go beyond form, beyond images, beyond all religion, beyond all restrictions. Learn to feel the free spiritual winds dancing around you. and lifting you, soaring high like an eagle into the heavens. Pray with me, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy light. I feel the love and ecstasy of Thy glorious presence. Keep me forever there. And let me wander nevermore. Peace. Bliss. Amen. My arms about the light.